boys, everybody. So we begin by adjusting our motivation. It seems like it's quite an important part of our practice, is to continually coming back to thinking about or just considering for a moment, stop speeding around and stop distracting ourselves from ourselves and pause and think about where our life is taking us. Is it in fact where you want to go? And there's a Chinese expression, unless you change the direction you're headed, unless you change the direction, you're likely to end up where you're headed. And is where you're headed at the moment where you want to go? So, you know, this process of continually checking up in terms of our priorities. Where do I want to go? What kind of person do I want to be down the track? You know, maybe 5 years, 10 years from now. What would I like to be? What would I like to be doing? Quite often we just simply we drift into those ways of being and doing which come to define us. Circumstances push and we yield. And we end up perhaps somebody who we have never decided to be. You know, perhaps our greatest gift as human beings is our ability to make free and conscious choices. But we're only aware of, you know, freedom is not something which is given to us. It's not something like you can keep in the bank and, you know, you can go to sleep comfortably at night thinking about how secure you feel. Freedom, I think, is in the exercising of freedom. It only exists when it's used. And in this context, I think our freedom is to consistently choose the person that we want to be. In all the various, you know, short-term strategies, but also in terms of long-range strategies. You know, what we would like to see ourselves represent to our values, which kind of resonate, which give meaning to our life and purpose to ourselves, and what we're doing with this one crazy, precious life of ours. You know, what can I do, even if only something insignificant, to take that little step today and tomorrow toward that person I want to be? You know, we can make lots of long-range plans, and they're important. But, you know, life is very much lived in the little incidental, almost seemingly insignificant events which are occurring every day. And that's, I think, the place that we have to build a life, not in the dramatic moments, as, you know, those don't come very often, and perhaps we don't always make the best choices. But, you know, the overall quality of, you know, we can make a habit of becoming the person that we want to be, just as we have formed the habit in the past of who we are now. You know, what you do now is what you'll become. So it's always, the choice is always now, and always coming back to that. You know, I mean, these little choices that seem almost insignificant, it seems so minor, it seems so trivial. Like drops of water, maybe. You know, they build up after a while. They can become a tremendous force. They can bring about radical changes. So in this process, the purpose of our life, you know, this is orientation, is we call it Buddha. It's a good word. It can stand us in good stead, in the sense that it's the, you know, just simply is a, it's a metaphor. It represents, it stands in for all that we could hope to make of ourselves. What do we really aspire in our finest, most noble moments? What we would like to see our life stand for, be a reflection of, when we can feel good about ourselves and respect ourselves and go beyond ourselves and be there for others in some real significant ways. We call that a Buddha. And but we have to do some work. It's, you know, it's fine, and it's It's inspiring to think in these ways. But then there's the practical necessity of actually doing the work to bring about these changes, to actually make us the person that we want to be. And, you know, we use these various techniques, this educational process that we're involved in, you know, these teachings, and our meditations and reflections, our discussions, you know, all the things. You know, it doesn't have to be in a formal way, just the books that we read and the way, thinking on the bus or driving home from work or wherever, the way that we talk to people and the things that we talk to people about. And most succinctly, the truth of things, you know, the way things actually are. Always trying to come to that. That's a life's task, isn't it? And it's the truth which makes us free, which transforms us. And I've been trying to go beyond. And it's a tremendous undertaking, I think. In that way, I think Buddhism demands a great deal of us. It demands that we become a Buddha, the best of ourselves, that to go beyond this set of fiction that we're continually projecting upon other people and the situations and the things about us, the fantasy that we take for reality, the substitute life that we live, and you know, working together. The Sangha, the spiritual community, and that's us. Coming together in the ways that we do and supporting each other, supporting the circumstances by means of which we come together, Buddha House. Acting as inspirations for one another and good examples. I think that's terribly important, isn't it? Seeing someone over time, you change for the better, is inspiring, isn't it? Seeing someone who isn't as troubled as they once were, who is beginning to not only working through their own problems, but you can see that they're beginning to develop in their ability, you know, using their own material that they work through, and that wisdom that they developed along the line, and the ways that they cared for themselves, being expressed, and doing the same for others, helping them to work through their material, helping and caring for them, and trying to raise the level of a motivation. You know, if we can develop the motivation just for that one person, you know, within your own, you know, right now, within your mind's eye. If you can just bring to mind one person that you'd like to be there for in some more significant way, a little more understanding, a little more caring, a little more patient, then everything that flows out of that motivation is going to act as an antidote to our general tendency towards self-centeredness, toward exaggerated self-concern, to thinking only of ourselves, which is the root of our problems. So that motivation, the directionality that you're giving your mind through that, through your intention, the why behind and the purpose for coming and listening to these teachings and discussing them and so forth, is actually all of what we do acts as a way to help ourselves, as an antidote to this tendency towards self-centeredness. So, you know, I ask you, just to pause. Take the time to get in touch. It's for you. There's some. It's for your own good. It's there's some kind of payoff in it. You know, it's not. There's no moral obligation or imperative. We're not trying to be good boys and girls. We're trying to help ourselves, and this is one way that we can, even at this immediate moment, you know, rather than thinking about, well, maybe tomorrow or the next day, at this very moment, we can help ourselves in a real substantial way. By thinking of one other person, I'd like to be there for you. And beyond all my own crazy mind and my own selfishness, in my better moments, I'd like to be there for you. I'd like to learn to be able to be better, to be able to be there more and more for you. that's more of the type of person I'd like to be. And I'd like to develop some skills and some wisdom, some abilities to be able to be a benefit for you. And it's something very immediate and personal, something very genuine. So though at this moment I'm only, you know, sitting here listening to this silly fool talking on, and perhaps we're going to have a discussion and do some meditation, but nonetheless I'm doing it for you. Somewhere down the line, I hope what I'm doing now is going to be a benefit for you. Go for refuge until I am awakened to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Through my practice of generosity and the other perfections, may I become a Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am awakened to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Through my practice of generosity and the other perfections, may I become a Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am awakened to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Through my practice of generosity and the other perfections, may I become a Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the joy that is without sorrow. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for some and aversion toward others. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, those actually arranged and imagined. I disclose all my negative actions accumulated during beginningless time and rejoice in all the virtues of superiors and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for migrating beings. I dedicate all virtue, my own and that of others, to the Great Awakening. We're going to meditate together. We're going to meditate on equanimity. So we've discussed equanimity. Equanimity is the foundation of this first meditative tradition for the development of an awakening heart, the seven cause and effect instruction. And we're trying to develop an unconditioned regard for others as the psychologically even ground, creating the open space where our minds aren't continually being buffeted by, you know, these emotions of attachment, aversion, and indifference. And a mind which is unconditioned with those reactive patterns of mind. And we're going to, within that space, that even mindedness, and then we're going to relate on the basis of a positive regard, of love. But as long as our mind is continually caught up, you know, in these reactive patterns of categories and then automatically emotionally reacting with attachment to friend, to those we categorize as friends, aversion to those who we categorize as disagreeable people, enemies, and with indifference to the vast majority of others, those we consider strangers, there's no way that we can really create the conditions whereby we can develop this unconditional positive regard. There's no space in the mind. The mind is completely caught up in these appearances and all the emotional baggage which is attached to these appearances. So we're going to work with this, and you know some people, you know, I try to talk about the fact of the difference between attachment and love. And quite, some people see it as the same. Some people see attachment as something valuable, as a useful emotion, and so forth. And here, you know, attachment is the quality of fixating. You know, it's clinging to an object, exaggerating its positive qualities, filtering out. It's an imbalanced mind. It's seeing not the individual, but our idea about the individual, and it's relating in terms of that. And moreover, it's relating in terms of what's in it for me, and it's not concerned with the other, which is, you know, has nothing to do with love, does it? Love is concerned with the other and the welfare of other, you know, bringing happiness to the other. So there's a tremendous difference between the two emotions, though they probably are mixed. We generally have both toward the same person from time to time. And the opposite is true of aversion. So we're trying to develop, trying to see through these appearances. You know, if we look at the reasons that we give for why we are attached, why we call this person a friend, why this person is an enemy, and this person is a stranger. You know, on the what do we keep seeing? Because of how they related to me. This person helped me. This person hurt me. This person hasn't done anything to me. It's always in terms of this me, of our self-centered opinions, our neediness, our wants. It's always in terms of ourselves. On those bases, we label, we categorize, we make these judgments, friend, enemy, and stranger. And then we habitually, automatically react with attachment, hostility, and indifference. So, is it realistic to judge others on how they are relating to me? Are others really good or bad from their own side or from our side? What are they in and of themselves? In and of themselves, all beings want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. You know, that's the nature of sentient life. An emotional reaction based upon that reason is in keeping with the reality of the person from their side. That person wants to be happy. Therefore, the emotional reaction of love is justified. It's a reasoned reaction. It's based in the reality of the person. From their side, they want to be happy. Therefore, to wish them happiness is in accord with their state of being. And it's a way that we can relate with them in a realistically reasoned fashion. You know, how would friend, enemy, and stranger, how would they appear to us if we stopped discriminating them on how they relate to me? If, you know, on terms of our own self-centered opinions, our needs and our wants. If we stop relating, you know, how would these three categories appear if we cease discriminating, judging them, classifying them in terms of what's in it for me, in terms of my self-centeredness? Then we could really see them for what they are. Maybe for the first time, we could really look at our partner or our friend, or what, you know, maybe also the enemy and the stranger. So it allows a very, you know, everyone is an individual. They aren't categories. Categories are useful, but they overlook the uniqueness of the individual. Your partner or your friend or your mother or your parent, they're all individuals. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about sitting there and holding the hands of your mother or whoever, and looking at them, looking into their eyes, as if for the first time, trying to see them as if for the first time, not our idea about them. And trying to see the person, this person who wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer there in front of yourself. This real flesh and blood, imperfect, sometimes pain in the ass person that we have to learn how to love, to relate with in some kind of positive fashion. Not our ideals about them, not what it's in it for me, but try to be, see them for what they are. You know, who are we to, you know, these appearances that we get caught up in? You know, who are we to be attached to? Who are we to hate? One person gives us a gift yesterday and slaps her face today. Another person slapped her face yesterday, gives us a gift today. And who are you going to be attached to? Who are you going to feel aversion toward? And they're both exactly equal in the long term. They've treated you, they've related you in the exact same way. And so it's trying to see that on the basis of a few reasonings, and these reasonings are susceptible to change. The reasons we make these classifications can change in the snap of just the snap of a finger, the shape of the mouth, you know, a smile or a frown can cause these appearances to change, these friend, enemy, and stranger. So we're not clinging so tightly to these labels, these appearances, and beginning to create some perspective on these appearances so that we don't automatically relate in terms of these appearances with the emotional baggage that we usually carry it with us in how we relate whenever we use these categorizations. And we're trying to develop an even-mindedness, an unbiased attitude toward these three. You know, if you could see these three in terms of from their own side, they simply want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. You know? And not in terms of our own self-centered opinions and judgments about them, our neediness about them, what they can do for us, but seeing their reality. That's their reality. You know, in the Pali language, there's a word called atta. I don't know much about Pali, but I was reading about this word the other day. And atta means, it has two meanings. It's a very useful word. This was the word that Buddha used when he talked about the goal of the spiritual life. He said it was atta. And it's like good. It means good. But it also means the goal. The goal is good. He said, my teachings bring about what is good for you. At first he didn't say Buddhahood or enlightenment or nirvana. He just said it is what brings about good for you. Our goal is to be is good. What is good for us? So, talking about these people the way that we do, you know, rather than seeing them in terms of what's in it for us, perhaps we can see them in terms of what is good. What is good for them, and what is good for ourselves. It's good for us to love. It's part of our goal. You know, as I said last week, I think it was, you know, that it's not so much that as adults that we need to be loved, but more that we need to love. That's good. That's a goal. So, okay, I'm carrying on. We'd like to stand up and stretch for a moment, then we'll meditate. So I'll explain the meditation on equanimity, and then we'll do it. In the meditation on equanimity, we're going to imagine on your right side, we've gone through this last week, I believe, on your right side is someone you know, that you naturally care about, that you like a great deal, that you love a great deal, you feel close to. On your left side, in front of yourself, is someone, a disagreeable person, you know, someone you have some problems with, you don't like. And then in the middle is a stranger. Okay, someone you feel indifferent toward, you don't have much feelings for in any particular way. It's as if they don't matter. And we begin to question, well, why do I label that person as my friend, as my, as the person who I care so much about? You know, what kind of reasons? And we begin to supply the various reasons. You know, maybe they helped me, or they gave me something. So you begin to develop, going through these reasons, and you develop this sense of closeness. You know, like you really begin. It's almost you want to, you know, bring them close to you, like almost cuddle them, hug them, hold them close to you, and try to get a sense of that appearance, of how they're appearing, so positive, exuding a sense of desirability from their side, a sense of lovableness from their side, a sense of goodness from their side. You know, that's where it appears, and you want to bring that close to you. And then we're going to introduce some contrary reasons, you know, thinking about some time when this person hurt you, when they said something that harmed you, or you didn't like, or they treated you in a way, intentionally or unintentionally, which made you feel bad, or they didn't do what they said, some reason, and then they're going to try to get a sense of how that appearance begins to change. We want to develop the ability to not to cling to these appearances automatically, as we, you know, now it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction. With the appearance, we react with a specific emotion. If you begin to develop the skill around in which you create some space of not automatically reacting to these appearances with these emotions which are normally associated with them, you begin to have a sense, you know, this person, the appearance, their lovability, their desirability, their likability, all their goodness can begin to radically change. Your mind just supplies a few reasons. On the basis of the reason, their appearance changes. So you don't fixate like you did before. You know, that was a characteristic of attachment, fixating and clinging to an appearance. Moreover, it's an appearance that you're actually projecting. We begin to see how these appearances are susceptible to rapid change, and we don't quite. There's not the quite the the automatic reaction to them, the reactivity to that appearance. You know, we actually begin to not get so fixated upon that particular appearance, because we can see how our mind can change that appearance. And we do the same with the enemy. You know, what are the reasons I hold this person to be such a, I don't like this person, I hold them in this way, I put them in this classification, I judge them in this way. You know, maybe they did something, said something to me, and so forth. And then we do the contrary. Having a sense of that, how they're appearing to you, then supply some other reasons, the contrary reasons, how this person harmed you, how they hurt you. You know, if you can't think of it in terms of your present history with this person, you know, you can imagine what they might do, what they could say. And gain a sense of how that appearance changes. And, you know, and then, what could they do to make you feel good about them? Maybe they could help you, give you a gift, say something kind, and try to get a sense of how that appearance changes. You know, you don't get so caught up, so fixated upon appearances. You begin to develop this. You begin to see how these appearances can fluctuate, just on the basis of a few arbitrary reasons. I can almost play with appearances. And so we don't take them as imbue them with a reality as we once did, as coming from their own side, as so concrete, independent of my mind, as we normally do. And so we don't automatically react to them with the same emotion or intensity as we did. We begin to create some kind of space we get some kind of perspective. In that perspective, we're going to try to create love in that space that we're creating between our habitual emotional reactions to appearances and those appearances. In that space, we can begin to cultivate love and compassion on the basis. People can still appear as enemies, but we can learn how to love them. We can create that way of relating, even if the appearance remains the same. And with this indifferent person, you know, why is it they don't matter to you? You know, they haven't helped you. You know, it's always in terms of me, isn't it? They haven't helped me. They haven't hurt me. They haven't done anything to me. But what if they did? And what happens when you begin to supply some other reasons? Positive first, or negative. You can begin to play with these, you know, they smile, they give me a gift. All at once they appear very lovable, desirable, friendly. I no longer emotionally relate with them the same way. So we develop the skill around these appearances. The appearances will be there. But we don't automatically relate to them in the same way. We're creating some kind of space. We don't fixate upon any of these three categorizations. And on that foundation, we can develop a more even-minded attitude. And in that space of unconditionedness, a way of looking at these three categories without being conditioned with aversion, attachment, and indifference, we can begin to foster some new, more positive way of relating to all three equally with an even-minded, unbiased attitude. Take a firm, comfortable posture. We begin by relaxing the body, beginning at the crown of the head, the scalp, the forehead, feeling the wrinkles in your brow beginning to smooth out. The pressure in and around your eyes diminishing. The muscles of the face softening, relaxing. Your jaw is relaxed. Moving to the muscles of the back of the neck, perhaps gently turning your head to each side. Very gently loosening, stretching the muscles of the back of the neck. And moving down, relaxing the muscles of the throat. And the upper back and shoulders, perhaps rotating your shoulders a few times, lifting them, allowing them to drop comfortably to the sides. And just feeling this weight, this burden, moving down and through your body into the ground. You've been carrying quite a burden over the course of the day. Now you can let it go. You can drop it. Moving all the way down to your hands. Your hands are loose and soft. Relaxing your lower arms, your upper arms, your chest is at ease, relaxing throughout the heart area. And the lungs, the central region of the back, the stomach, releasing the tension that we hold in our stomach muscles, just allowing your belly to go soft. relaxing throughout the abdominal cavity. Your lower back muscles. Buttocks. Throughout your upper legs. Your lower legs, and your feet. Now bring your awareness to your body in general, perhaps roughly moving through your body from the crown to your toes. If you come across any tightnesses, any tension, relaxing those areas consciously, feeling the tightness loosen, the tightness diminish, the tension diminish. If you come across some area of discomfort, accepting it, not resisting or struggling against it, allow it to be there. Breathe into it with a sense of acceptance and kindness, a gentleness with where you're hurting. Feeling a sense of physical well-being pervading every part of your body. Just be with your body. Practice the 6-part breath exercise, just breathing in normally, comfortably, breathing out, extending exhalation, forcing all the air out of the lungs, again breathing in normally, comfortably, again extending the exhalation, doing this 6 times individually. Completed that, bring your mind to the breath. Just the easy, gentle, in and out flow of the natural breath. And if it's helpful, use the techniques of counting and noting the breaths. now we're going to meditate on equanimity. So imagining on your right side, in front of yourself, is someone that you like, someone who you might is a friend, or but someone you care a great deal about. If you can't see them, it's not so important, but just feel that this person is there. The feeling's most important. On your left side is someone, a disagreeable person, someone you don't like, someone we might call an enemy, but just a disagreeable person, a problematic person. And in the middle, we're going to have a sense, or just a feeling, that there's a stranger. And first, we're going to look at the person on your right. And why is this person so attractive to you? Why do you like them so much? Why do you see them as a friend? Come up with some various reasons, thinking, which justifies this way of looking at them. Some of the reasons for holding this person as a friend. Do they usually involve how they're relating to me, what they've done for me, how they've helped me? Is it always in accordance in relationship to yourself? What is the nature of the reasons? Is it always in terms of yourself? And we're going to think in the opposite. We're going to think sometimes when we felt them to be an enemy, the same, very same person. When they hurt you, when they didn't do what you wanted them to do, for all the various reasons. So supply yourself, looking back in your history or imagining ways that they might hurt you or they have hurt you. How does their appearance change? They don't feel so comfortable putting them into the box of friend. And they can't quite put them back in that classification. Same person. Now let's look on your left side, look at the enemy, the person you find troublesome, you have some problems with. And one of the reasons they're so problematic, that you see them as an enemy, you put them in that box. How do they appear to you? Unlikable? Something about them is just not very attractive. So what were some of the reasons? What was the basis of those reasons? Was it always in terms of me? They hurt me. They didn't give me what I wanted. They didn't do what I wanted. Now supply some contradictory reasons, some opposite reasons. If you don't have the history, then just imagine that this person helped you, said something kind, gave you a gift. Notice how their appearance changes. They kind of brighten up a little more attractive. Same person, but they appear differently. They don't quite fit into that box of enemy as comfortably as they did before. Let's take a look at this person in the middle, this stranger, the one who doesn't matter. Why don't they matter to you? Why do you feel indifferent? What are the reasons? They haven't given me anything, they haven't done anything for me, they haven't hurt me, they haven't helped me. It's always me. Supply some contradictory reasons. Imagine this same person helping you, doing something nice to you, giving you a gift, smiling, making you happy. Their appearance and your reaction to that appearance change. Just get a sense of these three people together. Just have a sense that they're there, these three types of people. And from their side, they equally want to be happy. They equally don't want to suffer. No difference whatsoever among those three people there in front of you. Whether they appear as friend, whether they appear as enemy, whether they appear as stranger, from their side, their reality is they want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. Equally, no difference. exactly the same, all three. We lose sight of their reality, and we relate with them in terms of our self-centeredness, what they do for me, and we classify them, and we habitually and automatically react to those appearances with attachment, hatred, and indifference, which has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with us. And then bring your mind back to the breath. Get in touch with your body, perhaps the pressure of your buttocks on the chair or the cushion, the feet on the floor, positions of the various parts of your body. Just get in touch with the sensations and feelings within your body. Manner, just slowly become aware of your surroundings, connecting up with the room, taking your time. Working with this, the first of these two traditions to develop an awakened heart. I think Buddhism is quite a vast and profound. There's all various types of exotic practices, but I think there's lots we can do. But I think there's nothing more beneficial than simply to try to develop a kinder heart. You know, what is the Dalai Lama said? My religion is kindness. So this is very much what we're talking about. We're going to develop independence upon six causes. The seventh result, which is the awakened heart. So beginning with a sequence of six causes, we're going to try to recognize all sentient beings as our mother, remember their kindness, develop a gratitude which wishes to repay their kindness, appealing love, great compassion, exceptional resolve, and then which leads to the result of the awakened heart. So beginning with the first of these, recognizing all sentient beings as our mothers. This is a difficult tradition, I think. It's a challenge. Bhavanka Rinpoche, one of the greatest of 20th century, early 20th century Tibetan masters, said, you know, this graduated path, this sequence of the stages of realizations working all the way up to awakening that we've been working through, there are the two most difficult R1, to see your teacher as a Buddha, and 2, to recognize all sentient beings as your mother. The two most difficult, it's more difficult than emptiness. So if you feel that's a challenge, you're quite right. We're trying to come to a recognition that every living being has literally, not figuratively, but literally been our mother in the past. You know, we've talked about rebirth. I think when we discussed when we were talking about the wheel of conditioned existence, you know, we said that all products, this table is a product, this building is a product, I'm a product, my body is a product, that all products are dependent upon two types of causes. One was a substantial cause, and the other was a cooperative cause. There is always a similarity of type between the substantial cause and its result. And this is one of the one of the basic reasonings behind the proof of rebirth. That within nature, there is always a similarity of type between cause and effect. That there is, you know, fire, let's see, water, ice comes from water, smoke comes from fire, an apple tree comes from an apple seed, and there's always this similarity in time between its principal cause and the result. And the same holds to mind. If we trace back our mind at the present moment, and as we sit here now, it is in cause and effect relationship with the mind that walked into this door at 7:15 approximately. That mind, we could trace back moment by moment a cause and effect relationship, a continuum of replicating of moments of mind back to, you know, this morning when you woke up. We could trace that mind back to when you went to sleep last night. We could trace that mind in an uninterrupted continuum of cause and effect moments back to last year, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when you were a child, at the moment of birth. The mind within the fetus in the womb, all the way back to the moment of conception, the first moment of mind in this life. That mind too had a similar cause, had a cause which is similar in type to itself. The cause of that mind at the moment of conception, was the last moment of the mind of the previous life. An unbreaking continuum, just like from the present mind to that mind in the fetus. You know, there's not a break in that continuum. One mind arising in dependence upon the previous mind. And that mind at the moment of conception, it also arose in dependence upon a previous mind. And that was the last moment of mind of the previous life. And that mind rose in dependence upon a previous mind, tracing back with infinite regression from life to previous life to previous life to previous life without beginning. Mind only arises from mind. It doesn't arise from nothing, nor does it arise from a cause which is dissimilar in type to itself. The same holds true for matter. Matter does not arise from nothing. It only arises from a cause similar in types for itself. We can never posit a first moment of an atom of matter in the universe. It is beginningless. And likewise with regard to our mind, it too is beginningless. Each of our mental continuums is without beginning. Over the course of these infinite beginningless mind, we've taken infinite beginningless rebirths. Just as we took rebirth as a human being in this life, we've taken infinite rebirths in the past. And just as we had a mother in this life, we've had infinite mothers in these previous past rebirths. Mm. at the moment of our death, when we, you know, we talked about when we talked about the wheel of life, the wheel of conditioned existence, we have these karmic seeds within our mind, these which give directionality to our mind, which these seeds are activated at the moment of death by craving. Craving is the cooperative cause, activating, giving our mind some kind of impetus to reassociate itself with the new gross embodiment. So, you know, we want to develop a sense. The basis that all sentient beings are in our mother can't be developed on the basis of thinking of the I of Jhampa, this person sitting in front of you, or the person sitting where you are. On that I, that doesn't make sense to try to develop it on the basis of this I, this particular I. We have to develop a sense of what is called a mere I. There is an unbroken continuity of subtlemost energy in combination with subtlemost mind. We've talked about this in the past. Okay. This subtlemost mind is us. Why is it us? Because it has our whole karmic history encoded in it. You know, these karmic seeds that we're continually creating by what we think, by what we say, by what we do. It leaves an impression upon this mind. So it's thus, your mind is not my mind. It's a very distinct mind. It has its own predispositions, its own tendencies, its own capacities, its own karmic history. So it's a distinct mind. So we have this subtlemost energy and subtlemost mind in a continuum of replicating moments. On this basis of subtlemost mind, subtlemost body, we label I, person. This is the simplest basis for labeling a life. What constitutes life? Subtlemost energy, subtlemost mind. On that basis, we can label I, person, not person, I, sentient being, living being. On that basis, that's the continuum. That is the thread through it all. Due to craving, this subtlemost mind and energy will reassociate with a gross embodiment, you know, like that of a human. It enters into the fertilized ovum of a human being, of a female. It connects with that gross embodiment and develops. But eventually that the karmic bond which is sustaining that connection between the subtlemost mind and energy and this gross embodiment will weaken. The body dies. The body simply perishes. It decays. But this subtlemost energy, this what we're labeling I, continues on. And due to the force of craving, it will again reassociate with new embodiment. It may be of a dog. And then we can label I on the dog. When the karmic bond between that dog gross embodiment and the subtlemost energy weakens, finally breaks, the dog dies, the body decays, but this continuum of subtlemost energy and subtlemost mind, which are labeling I, continues on. There is this continuity of I. It will go on to again re-embody with that gross embodiment of human, perhaps. Jhampa, a particular I. I am this particular I. Jhampa, you know, I was born in, where was I born? Belfountain, Ohio, the United States. You know, I have this particular I, but that the particular I, Jhampa, which I'm labeling on this gross body and mind, eventually will cease. It will decay. But the subtlemost mind energy, which is associated with that particular I, what we're calling the mere I, will continue on. So there's this continuum, this endless thread from beginningless time, backwards and forwards, which we're calling the mere I. And we're going to get a sense of this mere I. I am a particular moment, a particular embodiment of this mere I. This is why I can say I took rebirth as a dog, or I took rebirth as a human. This, because of this continuity which we can label I. is being reassociated again and again. So it's a dependence upon this, getting a sense of this I, of which I am a particular instant of, you know, like a wave on this ocean, you know, an expression of. All sentient beings have had a relationship to that mere I, of that of a mother. And over the beginningless time that this mere I has been going through this process of association, disassociation, reassociation, connecting up, disconnecting, reconnecting, infinitely again and again over during beginningless time. Every sentient being in the web of, you know, interrelatedness of all sentient life has been as acted as a mother, has existed in relation as a mother to this mere I. Every sentient being has related to this mere I as our own mother at some time in the infinite past. Literally, we have been born to every sentient being. There's no person we can point to and say, this person has not been my mother, literally, at some time in the past. You know, all the various people, you know, whoever you might see, you know, you, each person in this room has been my mother, has been each of our mothers, has been our brothers, our sisters, and you know, all the various types of ways of relating over infinite time, infinite numbers of time. You know, in spite, we have a sense of unrelatedness with the vast majority of beings. In spite of that sense, in fact, everyone has been our own mother. You know, our relationships, even in the course of this life, aren't static. You know, continually changing. Even the course of a single lifetime. So every birth is a rebirth. You know, we've been dying. We died in a previous life, and we died in the previous life to that, and we died in the previous life. We're born into life after life after life. So when a meditator is trying to meditate on recognizing all sentient beings, it's important that you try to have a sense that you're not developing on the basis of this I, this particular ego of Jhampa, but on this sense of relatedness to this mere I, which constitutes me. You know, the great master Atisha once said, he saw a horse that was injured, and he screamed out, "My mother's hurt, my mother's hurt." And that was said to be his, expressed his realization that all sentient beings were his mother. Okay, recognizing all sentient beings as one's mother. It takes a lot of work, okay. Now we're going to begin to remember their kindness. You know, this has, you know, it's not sufficient that we simply relate, even if we were to have a sense of relatedness to others as being our mothers. We want to develop even as profound as a relatedness as that of a mother and child. You know, we have to nourish this connectedness, this profound relationship of mother and child. You know, we have to reestablish the meaning and profound psychological associations that this sense of relatedness once held for us. You know, over time we lose that sense of what a mother, of what our mother meant to us at one time. Each of us is a human being and thus possesses human life, and a human care is literally vital to that life. Mere mechanical or hygienic care is not enough to sustain, or either physically or psychologically. When human attention, warmth, or care is deficient or absent, we perish. The more quickly and surely, the more vulnerable we are. And that death in such a context is first and foremost an existential death, a dying away of the will to live. And that paves the way for physical death. You know, it's difficult for us to imagine ourselves as we once were. You know, what it must have been like. to be completely vulnerable, completely defenseless. You know, we were at one time. You know, when you see a baby, and without its mother's constant care, that baby would perish, would die. It's completely vulnerable. It cannot take care of itself. You know, now we feel like we can take care of ourselves. We feel invulnerable. We feel, you know, we don't need anybody. We feel tough. But there was a time when we were, our life was literally dependent upon somebody taking care of us. Almost hourly, every day of our life. Every day of that child's life, that baby's life. When we first come into the world, we are utterly dependent. Without food, physical care, emotional sustenance, we cannot grow. Emotional connection is such an important feature of our survival that babies taken in care but given no love and personal attention cannot sustain life. They give up and die. Whoever cares for us first is most consistent, and most consistently, usually our mother, becomes our psychological umbilical cord. We depend upon her for our very existence. We are merged with her and have no sense of where we begin or where she ends. What she gives us emotionally forms a very essence of our personality. Her love and attention is an essential food that builds our personality. It is as important as the physical nurture we receive to develop our bodies. She fills up our world, and our first experiences, pleasurable and painful, take place in an emotional context in which she has created. We are enraptured by her, fascinated by, and very much need her. You know, when our mother tenderly took us into our arms and, you know, lovingly held us to her breast, and we felt her warmth, we felt her very life essence flowing into our body when we nursed at her breast. You know, there's probably no greater bliss that we as ordinary human beings ever experience in the course of our life than that moment of merger. You know, when it's said that when a yogi has direct realization of emptiness, their mind merges with a greater reality. The emptiness of all phenomena in the universe. But and their heart is filled with a joy, a bliss beyond ineffable, indescribable joy and bliss. But if they had never meditated, if they had never cultivated the sense of bliss of the merger with their mother, they would have never been able to open up to that greater bliss of the merger with infinite reality. Their mind would never have been prepared for such a state. You know, how many of us have ever felt thoroughly loved? You know, not for what we give or for what we withhold, or what we do or don't do. But how many of us have ever felt a love which can never be earned, you know, for which we can never make ourselves worthy or deserving for, because we are worthy of that love simply for the fact that we are, that we exist, that, you know, just our very existence makes us intrinsically lovable, worthy of being loved, unconditional love. A baby can't do anything. It can't repay. It can't ask. It can't say please. It can't entertain us in the way that we try to attract the good things that we want from others for ourselves. But it's simply just by its very existence, it is shown love. It doesn't have to. It cannot earn a mother's love. There's no way it can. But it's given love nonetheless. You know, a baby is completely vulnerable, helpless. it's only in need. And it has no way of earning its mother's love. It's remarkable, isn't it? It can't, there's nothing that it can knowingly do to return that love, to return that attention that it's given to. You know, it's constantly in need of attention, protection. It can't earn that protection. It can't earn that attention. It's totally oblivious to the physical and mental hardships and difficulties that it places upon it, its mother, who sustains it in life. You know, we come to take for granted what all that our mother at once gave us at one time, in a time that we cannot remember at present. And somehow we feel deserving of all that we get. All the pain and difficulties that we brought to our mother from the very first moment subsequent. You know, just thinking about from the very first moment subsequent to her awareness that she's pregnant, and that there's conception in her womb. From that very moment, her mind more and more turns her attention to us. You know, we're just a clump of cells, a few cells, a mass of cells, nothing more than that. But you know, we amazingly still we become the object of her concern. You know, we're just these bunch of cells, but still her attention is again and again paid to ourselves, this who we are. You know, how can a mere mass of cells, command the right that we become the central object of her concern? How can a mere mass of cells command the right that we bring health, that we threaten our mother's health, the possibility, all the discomforts of pregnancy and labor and birth, all the morning sickness. And there's a possibility of death in the birth itself. You know, completely helpless. And in need, we come naked into this world. You know, how could we rationally think that anyone, after hours of labor, the pain involved, could take us lovingly into their arms and forgetting all that just went before and hold us to her as if we were the most precious thing in all the world. And forgetting all the pain and the discomfort, everything has gone before. That only this seeing us as the most lovable. You know, this is like she's like this treasure, holding ourselves to her. You know, how can you deserve that? How can you earn that kind of attention, that kind of caring? There's no way you can, but it's freely given. Each of us experienced that. And all the years that follow out of that, you know, after that, you know, all the selfless giving that mothers do for their children, and the constant concern for us, you know, years of feeding us and cleaning us and clothing us and educating us, and years of, you know, hundreds of times a day, our mother turned her attention to us. Her concern was on us. Her worry was for us. Our needs, you know, our wants, 100 times a day, protecting us from many types of harm. 100 times a day, you know, putting our welfare before her own. And you know, she fed us, she cleaned us, she washed us, played with us, she held us, she sang to us. You know, she provided what she could. In a complete environment of safety and protection and for our well-being, she worried over us. She went without sleep sometimes for us. You know, she gave up a significant part of her life. You know, for this person you are now. There's a Japanese haiku which says, "Wild persimmons. The mother eats the bitter part." Like eating the burnt chop. That's the Australian version. That's the part that the mother usually eats and gives the best to the child. You know, out of our effort, you know, we have, the idea is to try to get to reconnect with some of these primordial feelings, this bond that was once there between you and your mother. You know, out of our infant eyes, our mother was our world. You know, to nurse at her breast was bliss. To hear her nearby was all the security that we needed to feel safe in the world. To be cuddled by her, was all the comfort that we needed in order to go back out there and face all the dragons of our life, that we were going to have to face in beginning to explore our world. We'd always run back to our mother when the dragons got too dangerous for us. Motherly love is the most frequent and most readily understood instance of productive love. During the birth of the child, the mother's body labors for the child, and after birth, her love consists in her effort to make the child grow. Motherly love does not depend upon conditions which the child has to fulfill in order to be loved. It is unconditional, based only upon the child's request and the mother's response. No wonder that motherly love has been the symbol of the highest form of love in art and religion. The Hebrew term indicating God's love for man and man's love for his neighbor is rachamin, the root of which is rachim. Womb. So it is the complete faith in utter dependency of the child, and its absolute trust that enabled Christ to, when he was on the cross, to say, "Father, into thy hands I commend myself. I commend my spirit," to be able to let go into a greater reality, and having that trust. And then this is what we learn as a child, as a baby, had we once learned it. This is the womb from which a bodhisattva is born, which empowers a bodhisattva to be able to dedicate their life toward others, toward all mother sentient beings. This womb of unconditioned love that we all experience, this profound primordial connection that we all experience at some time with all of every sentient being. There's a story about this is a Tibetan story, with bandits and swords and everything, and this one, during the course of this robbery that took place, a mayor who was in fold, she was cut along her side, and she fell, and her unborn foal issued from her womb. And even in the mare's, as the mare was dying, even in her death throes, she was licking the embryonic fluids from her dying foal, from the fetus. And it said that that this gesture, this that even in such the last moments of her life, her attention turned toward her young, so captivated, and so the bandit was so impressed that it became a life-changing experience, even for him, for someone whose heart was so hardened to see motherly love expressed in that way. But over the course of our life, our feelings begin to gradually dry up in one way or another. Feelings of this primordial bond beyond our thinking, beyond our, they begin to become eventually displaced with demands and expectations, kind of ultimatums. Slowly our hearts begin to close, and they begin to form a kind of a hard shell around ourselves, around our own heart, a hard shell of self-centeredness around our own hearts. And then we begin to play the game of calculated love. You know, our relations become transactions. The mentality of debits and credits. And if I do something for you, I get some credit. If you do something, I have a debit, I have to pay you back. And this is the business of getting along in life, the practicalities of life. So we've forgotten what it felt like to be loved for no other reason than that we exist. That we can't earn that love. There's no way that we can manipulate the other to love us in that way. You know, we've forgotten how it felt to be intrinsically lovable and to be loved unconditionally. At some time, we all were. You know, all the love, all the kindness that was showered upon us constantly. And now, having lost that feeling of our own existential worth, you know, we are unable to feel the same for others. How they are simply worthy of our love, simply because they are alive, for no other reason. And therefore we cannot love ourselves. We are unable to love even ourselves. We have to earn our own love. We have to meet some kind of standards. We have to fulfill some kind of criteria even to like ourselves. And then we just can't love ourselves simply because we are. So remembering the kindness of our mothers is meant to be like opening a wellspring of emotions and feelings associated with it. It's like a vivid re-experiencing of a long forgotten event and all the long displaced and repressed feelings that surrounded that event of being a baby. Completely unconditionally loved at some time in the past. So getting in touch with these primal feelings, and all these mental, all these images and memories, you know, and reconnecting to this fundamental bonding instinct of a mother and child. We're going to continue to talk a little bit more about remembering the kindness of our mother, our mother's love. Okay? Maybe we'll. There's quite a, Thich Nhat Hanh goes into this. He talks a lot about his love for his mother and what it's meant to him in terms of his practice and his spirituality. Maybe I'll read just a little bit, okay? This is Thich Nhat Hanh. The thought mother cannot be separated from that of love. Love is sweet, tender, and delicious. Without love, a child cannot flower. An adult cannot mature. Without love, we weaken, wither. The day my mother died, I made this entry into my journal. The greatest misfortune of my life has come. When I was a child, I heard a simple poem about losing your mother, and it is still very important for me. So this is the poem he heard. That year, although I was still very young, my mother left me, and I realized that I was an orphan. Everyone around me was crying. I suffered in silence. Allowing their tears to flow, I felt my pain soften. Evening enveloped mother's tomb. The pagoda bell rang sweetly. I realized that to lose your mother is to lose the whole universe. We swim in a world of tender love for many years, and without even knowing it, we are quite happy there. Only after it is too late do we become aware of it. People in the countryside did not understand the complicated language of the city people. When people from the city say that Mother is a treasure of love, that is already too complicated for them. Country people in Vietnam compare their mother to the finest variety of bananas, or to honey, sweet rice, or sugar cane. They express their love in these simple and direct ways. For me, a mother is like Bát Hồng, banana of the highest quality, like the best Nep Mot, sweet rice, like the most delicious Mì Lo, sugar cane. We'll continue next week, okay? So if you would like to get a cup of tea, we can talk about this.